You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is back open for live shows, classes, and customized corporate workshops and events. But we also have all those things available in virtual formats. For more information, go to secondcity.com. Today's pod, we welcome back Chad Sanders, who is a writer, director, actor, and musician based in New York City. Previously, Chad worked at Google and YouTube as a tech entrepreneur. He has since written or co-written TV series and feature films with collaborators Spike Lee, Morgan Freeman, and Will Packer. Chad's op-ed pieces have appeared in the New York Times, Slam Magazine, and Teen Vogue. We talked to him when his book came out, Black Magic, What Black Leaders Learn from Trauma and Triumph. Today, we're talking about a new podcast that he co-hosts with Julie Bowen of Modern Family fame. And that podcast is called Quitters. And this ended up being a really interesting conversation that went to a lot of different places. So I hope you enjoy the pod. The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at The Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another bed and left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Chad Sanders, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. A lot's happened since we talked last.
Wow. Yes. And actually, I'm curious, is your new podcast Quitters, like, did it grow out of the last 2 years? Is it very intentional with that?
I guess yes and no. Everything that I work on, and it's probably might be the same for you, it feels like it sort of grows over time, over months and years, just from different ideas, notes in your notes pads, things you're thinking about, things you're talking about with friends. And if I wanted to sort of boil it down for this one, I actually put pen to paper on the concept about 10 months ago. Mm-hmm. Because when Black Magic came out, I met Brené Brown because she was a big champion for the book. I went on her show as well. And she followed up with me immediately thereafter. And she was like, oh, you might have a voice for this podcasting thing. And I was like, oh, yeah, I've been thinking about it. I want to do it. And she said, I have a banner at Spotify. Do you want to come do it under my banner at Spotify? And so I put the concept together, I brought it to her, took it over to Spotify, and they actually made an offer for it, and it was an offer that I wasn't comfortable with. Mm. And so I couldn't go with her, and so then I just took the thing back, and it just was sort of kismet. Like, I met Julie Bowen, we wanted to work together, we started having conversations and finding that there was sort of an electricity and a tension there, and she had quit a marriage, an eating disorder, had quit a few things, and I obviously had quit my job at Google, among other things, and so like the concept just started to hash together, and we made the show.
What was interesting to me, and I've listened to all the episodes that I've aired so far, everyone's talking about the Great Resignation, and I'm like, I kind of think that's really a meaning crisis that's happening in America, and I feel like your podcast, while quitting is at the center, it's a lot more than that. It's about the reason, right, that someone is quitting, more so than the quitting itself.
Yeah, you know, it's the title is a little tongue-in-cheek. We're trying to take some ownership of the idea of deciding your future as much as one can, because nobody really can. Right. You know, for me, that was everything in my life and every person in my life that I was listening to at the time was pointing to this sort of corporate track. You know, you work at Google for 20 years, you try to claw your way to the top. if you leave, you go to another corporation and you try to, you know, leverage your way into a promotion. And it was like, that was the thing. That was, you know, the story I had been told of my own life. And I was trying to live out that story. And over time, realizing that that was not the real story for me, I had to jump ship. And that was the quit. And that was the proactive thing I was doing to say, I'm going to figure out what my own story is. I don't know what it is. It's scary. This is the abyss that I'm jumping into. I'm spinning, but like, I got to try something else because this doesn't fit for me. And that's really what we're talking about with quitting anything, with quitting cigarettes, with quitting a marriage, with quitting, you know, any shoe that doesn't fit. We're talking about, it's really just slicing something out of your life to make space for something new. You just don't necessarily know what the new thing is.
So I'm a bit older than you, but I have three quitting stories that I think basically define my entire life.
What are they?
The first was, so I had been up until junior year in high school, like my world, I was defined as a soccer player. So I'm the youngest of six boys. One brother was an All-American, another was All-State. I was considered maybe the best out of all of them. We went to the state championship. We lost. I quit after that and never played again. And then found my way into books and art and theater, which is how I have, you know, lived my life. I quit my first marriage, which I sort of felt like was a situation where, like, I don't think I'm being treated well. And then found the love of my life, who I've been married to for 25 years. And then in 2015, after I wrote Yes And, I quit my job at Second City. I had been running the theater. I ended up staying and carving out a new role, but it was like, and that was really scary because my kids were young and I didn't have anything else to go to. And I just recall my wife being like, if you need to do this, and I think you do, do this. Yeah. And these last years since I did that, I've completely redefined sort of, again, who I am. And I'm happier than I've ever been, even though sad stuff's happened. But it's like, and I look at those things as like, there's such a negative spin on quit. Mm-hmm. And yet, if I hadn't made those moves, I think I would have been trapped in a sea of unhappiness.
Sure. And I would also add, or I would suggest that in all three of those, it sounds like, and I'm curious to know if this is true, but it sounds like each one of those three things, soccer, your first marriage, and Second City, it sounds like all three of those things were things that at least at one point in time, you truly loved. Like you truly were enamored
for
by.
For sure. And then it changed.
And then it changed, right? And if you had tried to like chase the love that existed at one time forever, you probably wouldn't be sitting here with a very pure smile on your face as I've seen you do the last two times that I've spoken to you.
Yeah.
But the reason why I highlight that is because we're not, you know, this is not like a we're not public motivators. We're not, you know, this is not like It's not a religious show. You know, this is not a show where it's like rah, rah, shish, boom, bah, like just have faith and hope and it's all going to, you know, it's all going to be a great. This is the show where when we talk to someone who's an alcoholic about quitting alcohol as best they can, we want to talk about not just leaving that thing behind, but like, what was the thing you fell in love with? Tell us about the fun nights. Tell us about, you know, the good times. Tell us about the ride up before you realize that this thing was going to hit a wall and you needed to turn it around, you know, because I don't want to idolize the person who's in the thing or the person beyond the thing. We just want to really tell the story and understand it.
That's really insightful because we're messy as hell, us human beings, and the world we live in. I mean, like, we're recording this. You know, yesterday, Russia invaded Ukraine. These trans bills come out, right? I mean, it's just like the world was already just like terrible and problematic and all that. And there's even more. And yet, you know, you kind of got to get up and go through the day. And so that ability to sort of recognize the difficulties and move forward and try to be happy and make a difference in this world or whatever your thing is. What I think is important about your podcast is just that it's actually in a time where there's no nuance. Yeah. This is extremely nuanced.
Oh, thank you. Oh man, that is one of the most important compliments to me and to the show, because I know what I'm up against in terms of the marketing of the show. You know, my co-host and thought partner is Julie Bowen of Modern Family fame. This is something that could very, someone could very easily scroll past it because they're like, okay, great. Another Hollywood podcast, right?
Yeah.
Another like two, you know, successful people, one super successful person, you know, wealthy, kind of just like above it all, just sort of like bloviating and, you know, making ha ha hee hee and kind of almost basically networking with each other over my, over the top of my head. And I get a few jokes out of it. Like, that is not the show at all.
No.
And in fact, there's a lot of tension in between me and Julie in the show because we're both so dead set on making sure that never becomes the show. You know what I mean? And then, and to speak to the messiness of the world that we're in, the cool thing I like about this quitting concept is that it's not like we're trying to start a fire from nothing that doesn't already exist. Like you said, 40 million Americans quit their jobs last year because people spent some time with themselves over these last 2 years, I think, and took stock and inventory of like, what am I doing with my life every day? Who am I giving it to? And what are they giving me back? So we're in a sense, we're preaching to the choir a little bit with this topic. And we're really getting into other people's minds to learn from them. Like, why did you leave the thing behind?
And you have a thing that you, I have not heard it used yet in the podcast. And is it a bell that
yeah,
can get run? And really quickly, my wife, who's a comedy professor and longtime sort of theater director, teacher, she took this workshop that they were giving them around consent, especially, which is very difficult in improvisation because like you're just making it up. But basically there's a word that they have, which is button. Mm. And if you say button, no one's in trouble, whatever, everything just stops.
Yeah.
And everyone's got a beat and then they can figure out what they need to do from there. So tell us about the thing that you guys have. And I haven't heard it used yet.
Yeah, you haven't heard it in the first four episodes,
four,
which is funny because I just had a conversation with our producers about how we edit this thing. And I'm like, hey, we got to make sure because the bell gets rung almost every single time we record. But we only leave it in for the ones that we think actually help us tell the story. You know what I mean? Because sometimes you'll see. So I'll give you the story of the bell. So, you know, as these things happen, Julie Bowen kind of drops out of the sky. She heard me on Dax Shepard's podcast. Her producer reaches out. They're like, let's start working together. I'm like, great, let's do it. I have this concept. We start putting it all together. The producer's name is Rachel, just to give her a shout out. She's awesome. And you know, when my book comes out, Black Magic, this is after a period of probably 2 or 3 years of my life where I haven't really had any relationships with white people, you know, to be honest. This is like, I'm a little bit underground right now as a writer, just like kind of chiseling my way out. You know, the first thing that made a dent was this New York Times piece I wrote after George Floyd. Then I had people's attention. The book came out and then I started some people started entering my life. But so I'm very vulnerable. I'm very sensitive. And I'm like, how do I form a relationship with Julie Bowen without it getting back to how I felt at Google with so many of my managers and bosses and colleagues. And the first time I went to go to her house to record, I just brought this bell with me. I actually sent one to her house. And I was like, every time one of us has our feelings hurt, we're going to ring the bell and we're going to talk about it right there on the spot. And we continued to do it while we recorded and we've done it with our guests so that we don't just build, you know, so we don't build a relationship on toxicity. So we don't build a relationship on hurt feelings. So we don't have resentment when we look back 2 years from now, because now the train's moving and it can be really hard to police those things if you don't do it in real time.
So this is so relevant to a conversation we're having constantly in various spaces with various people, which is how do we stay in conversation to make the human experiment work requires us to stay in conversation with people with whom we disagree. I just don't think the other side of that is not good. So having to do that while also recognizing the massive inequities and systemic issues that still remain, that is such a tricky area to sort of play with. And I'm curious what are the guidelines for that? How you seem to manage it because you're entering with an element of goodwill that you don't necessarily like, I don't know that you right? Like, you have every right not to have that goodwill.
No. I mean, of course, you know, I think, and I guess I gotta be honest, like, sure, I have that right. And some people have every right / privilege to also not enter that, you know, that forum of conversation. I say it to Julie all the time. Like, you could just kind of float away in the clouds and like live your life on beaches and stuff. And a lot of people choose to do that. And, you know, I guess I will never talk to those people, but no. I think, you know, I don't think I am an expert on this. I'm learning a lot about it though. And I have to tell you, it's costing a lot of emotional energy to have these conversations over and over and over again. And the conversations shift and they meld. And already, as we get further and further away from George Floyd, that the dynamics of the conversations are changing. I went back to go speak at Google a few times over the last few months, and I can already see that sort of the energy and the enthusiasm to learn in the wake of George Floyd has waned, you know, and it's a little tired. It's a little sleepy in those rooms. The people that look like me are a little scared again about their job safety. So I think my job, to some extent, is to, because I'm sort of a free agent now, is to like say the things that people are getting scared again to say to each other out loud in a way that is honest, not overwritten, kind, you know, so that someone else can actually hear me. And so someone else will enter in dialogue with me. But the other thing I would say for the receiving end of that, and I'm on the receiving end of it often because I have my own layers of privilege, you know, I think sports is the right analogy for this. It's like, can you take the feedback? Can you hear someone say, I don't know soccer terms, I'll say it in basketball terms. Yeah. Can somebody tell you, you missed your assignment. You were supposed to help down on the baseline. You didn't do it. You know you didn't do it. This is why you have to do it. Can you just take that and can you just hear it and digest it and get it right the next time without lashing back at the person or without overwhelming them with, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, this is why I did it. I meant to do this. I thought it was this. I didn't do this.
Right.
You know what I mean? Can you just take the feedback and just get it right the next time? That's a big part of it.
We have an adage at Second City, which is take the effing note. So after a show or whatever it is, like, just take, you don't have to agree with the note. You don't have to like, but we're only going to efficiently get through the work we need to do if you just like hear it, take it, and we move on. Yeah. And like, I think that the one thing you and Julie seem to have is a psychologically safe space that you're in, that there is some, that there's realistic trust. Like you recognize the privilege, you recognize like your own, her, you know, and all that. And so I think like that's the only place where those kinds of things can occur. And I just wonder now in our country I don't know, like a CPAC was yesterday, right? I was seeing on Twitter various like insane lies and other. It's like, I don't know could I walk in that room and have a conversation with these people? I don't.
Right.
And as much as I believe this is like my work is all about like that stuff now, but I don't know that I could, because I just don't, it doesn't feel psychologically safe. And I don't think they're operating in good faith.
Well, I think artistically you're pointing out something that I often forget about the show, which is that we live on opposite sides of the country. We are actually both from Maryland, but totally two different sides of the state. I would expect that our families have very different political beliefs. We are in two different tax brackets. You like the list goes on and on. We're in two different generations. This is my main issue with Twitter bullying and Instagram comments and just the meanness, the rudeness. It's like, this isn't human nature when two actual people are looking at each other. Like this is something different. This is something aside from that. And certainly people are capable of cruelty face to face, but there are far more people who are truly capable of that cruelty than exist on internet in chat forum, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
And so when me and Julie, you know, so to speak, line up across from each other and get into dialogue, like there's so much happening in the way of nonverbal communication that is taking care of each other, making sure the other person's okay, making sure that joke flew and didn't actually hurt too much. Like And then also taking care of the guest as well. And then the things we talk about in real time after we record, we had a big fight, our first real fight a couple weeks ago, because I'm an introvert, she's an extrovert. I'm a writer, she's an actor. I am more prone to listen and let the person completely finish spiel before I jump in. She is like, probably more like, as it is an improv, more, it's more zing, zing, zing. It's back like, I'm forth, jumping in, they're jumping. Mm-hmm. And she's like, look, for the show to work, it can't just be my voice and the guest. Like, you are the writer. You need to jump in and assert yourself and cut through with questions, with ideas, with mm-hmm. perspective. And it's just, I think, to bring it back to your question, like, she's saying that because she cares about me. And I am doing right. the opposite because I care about her. And, like, right. that's natural for human beings. And I hope we can get back to that. I hope we can get out of our internet selves and back into our bodies.
My friend Kim Scott calls that radical candor. This idea yeah. that I can only get through to you if you know I love you, that kind mm-hmm. of thing. So like that's where it goes. Okay, I did a thing which I think you're going to find funny. Yeah. I looked up quitting quotes on Goodreads.
Okay.
So here are the first three. The very first three, which means they're the most sort of cited. First is by Michael Jordan. If you quit once, it becomes a habit. Never quit. Second is Lance Armstrong, who says, pain is temporary, quitting lasts forever. And the third is Douglas MacArthur. So I want us to know we're going from Michael Jordan to Lance Armstrong to Douglas MacArthur. And he says, age wrinkles the body, quitting wrinkles the soul. All of them completely negative.
Huh. That's interesting.
Partially so on the idea of quitting.
You know, what's funny is, and this is the thing with language, it's like, well, I'm sure there's truth to what all three of them are saying. And sure. and I can slice it up in all these different ways to make them true. Lance Armstrong is a cheater, right? And right. and honestly, there is, you know, especially coming from the tech world, it's all about finding the cheat. It's all about finding the unfair advantage and exploiting it until you make $1 billion. And then you can pay off your legal funds for whatever it is that you've done wrong. Right.
Right.
So there's a whole, you could look at any one of those three people and say, well, okay, MJ, like, yeah, you never quit your pursuit of a title of a NBA championship, but you probably quit football. You probably quit creative writing class. You probably, you know what I mean? Like
yeah.
the point of what we're saying is it's not like quit everything. It's not leave everything behind. It's figure out the stuff that is you, that inspires you, that makes you feel good, that you love doing every day. And if you can, if you have such a privilege and if you can figure it out, like maybe quit the other stuff. If you can, that's really what we're talking about. I think we have in American culture, especially, like such an obsession with enduring pain. It's just like, right. we love that, you know, struggle, feel bad, be broke, be hurt, be sad, like do it, do it, do it. And then on the other side of that is joy. What if on the other side of that is death? And then that's it. And it's over. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not willing to risk it. That's a risk I'm not willing to take. I want to start doing the stuff I love to do every day.
That's right. And it's interesting, on the Yes And podcast, we've had a series of guests, whether they're talking about boundaries, whether they're talking about toxic positivity, the importance of a no.
Yes.
And that's true in our work too. Yes And is about like this messy beginning part of creativity. It's the opening 5 minutes of a brainstorm. But once you get all this stuff together, you've got to employ your no's. And so like, I feel like that power of saying no is something that we can't forget is a big part of life, because people will drain you.
Oh, absolutely. That's like something I'm so focused on this year, is learning how to say no. Mm-hmm. There's three people who I sort of admire who have, and I'll give them to you quickly, who have either told me or said something to someone else about no. So Oprah said this, not to me. No is a complete sentence. I love that one. Mm-hmm. Brene Brown said to me, you know, after the book came out, she said, I was just calling her for kind of just general advice on next steps and what to do with myself. Yep. And she was like, the most important thing is, everything happens on your time. You choose, like, mm-hmm. you, and if it doesn't fit your timetable, then the answer is not now. And the third, and it relates exactly to what you just said, was Mike Schur, the creator of The Good Place and
a new book. Yeah.
Got a new book. He used to be on one of the writers on SNL. And he was talking about how you pour everything into that SNL sketch. You give it all you have. You present it to the writer's room. And when it's over, if it doesn't go, like, it's over. You put it behind you. And that to me is like saying no to the idea that everything, every failure is going to haunt you and stick with you for the rest of your life.
Yeah. That you alluded to this maybe in the first podcast, but have you been doing comedy writing or stand up, or there was something about that?
Yeah, so I write for a comedy for HBO Max, which will come out this year. Ostensibly, that's not an announcement. Like, there's no announced date, but I expect that it will come out this year. And I've written, you know, comedy for TV before, but I do have one of my big audacious dreams is I do want to do stand up. I do want to do like a stand up special would be the real dream. So I'm starting to wrap my brain around what the process for developing something like that would be, and like learning how to do it and all that stuff. But I think
have you been like hitting small rooms and doing like your tight 5 or 10?
I'm at ground zero. This is like
because that's it. By the way, ground zero is just walking into that room that you sign up and you go up and you're terrible.
I'll do it.
That's and then. And you find your voice, and the only way you find your voice is by being terrible and watching other people. And then the other thing, it's funny, my wife's finishing up her second book, which is called Funnier, and the title is based on, she runs a comedy major, the first ever in America, at Columbia College. And dads will come up to her at open houses and say, are you going to make my daughter or son funny? And she goes, I can't make them funny. I can make them funnier. I can find the thing that is authentic in them. Mm. And, you know, she taught Amy Poehler. It's like, not everyone's going to go and be Amy Poehler or A.D. Bryant, who she taught, but they might end up being funny enough that that's going to be useful to them in their job or in a relationship or whatever. So it's like, this major is not going to be a waste, believe me, because the shortest distance between two people is a laugh.
And, there was one of my mentors, this guy, Tom Straw. He's a showrunner for like Nurse Jackie and his thing is, if you can make somebody laugh, you can change their mind. And I think that's spot on.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's why suddenly we're turning to in the last decade, you know, who are we turning to? Cause it's not Walter Cronkite anymore. We're turning to Colbert or Stewart or Trevor Noah or, you know, and there are truth tellers, and it's like John Oliver, genius, that long form stuff is just incredible. Yeah. And I think in fact, because like the other people have betrayed us, and the thing about comedians is they're outsiders. That's why they're seeing what's going on, because they're definitely, and it feels like that's why it wasn't a surprise to me that you were getting the comedy, because your book is all about what it means to be on the outside looking in, and you did that from the inside, and you've done that from the outside.
Yeah, and if I'm honest, you know, there are people, and I think that they're so important, and I think that they are different from me, who write about race and who write about these dynamics, and they live in that world. Like, they study it nonstop. They talk about it nonstop, and they are grave in the way that they communicate. I like to have a good time. Like, like this stuff is very important to me. It's a lot of it is what I go to bed thinking about at night and wake up thinking about, you know, but at the same time, like, I have other ways of communicating. I like to have fun. I like to make a joke. I like to make somebody uncomfortable and then bring them back, you know, into a hug. Like, that's my thing. I don't know if you're, I would love to have a conversation with your wife about, where do I start here? I know she's, you know, probably got a very full schedule of people to do that
with.
I do think there's something to it. You know, I don't love everything Dave Chappelle's talking about right now, but he is someone who can sit down in a chair, talk to a room of, you know, 2,000 people, walk them through a story and lead them somewhere that they didn't expect to go. And it feels true the entire time. And I think that's a really, that's just such an amazing pursuit. I would love to try to do that.
Yeah. No, I mean, this is like, having this. So Ann and I have both worked at Second City over 30 years. So we've gotten to see a lot of different people sort of hone their voices. And she was Colbert's roommate in college. So that's like, and I've told the story before, but like when the Colbert Report came on, Ann and I were watching the first episode in bed and we're like, well, that was genius. There is no way he can keep doing this. Like, it just seemed impossible. How do you maintain that? And he did it for like a decade. And right. it was just like that level of it's almost like athleticism, right? It's the same thing when you look at what LeBron does. You're like, at LeBron's age, like, you should not be able to move like you're moving. And then what you figure out is, oh, no, he's been doing yoga and training his body and eating in a certain way.
That's right.
And I think that is the same for these really gifted comedians, is that they continue to work on. I don't like what Chappelle's doing right now either, in terms of a lot of what he's talking about. But there's no question that he has continued to hone his craft.
And exercise.
It's just like really, really hard work, like any sort of peak performance is. And I think the thing about the podcast is actually going to be a place where you could start applying some of that as well, right? I mean, I like, it was interesting, your conversation with Jimmy Kimmel. Would I use the word sanguine? I was like, oh, this is interesting, because while he didn't explicitly say, I'm going to quit this job, he was kind of talking about quitting his job.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what does sanguine mean? You got to teach me something.
A sanguine is like a little sad.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay. That's so, when people asked me, just like family, you know, like, what was he like? What was the conversation like? He was like this kind of like funny librarian, almost, was I thought his way.
Yeah.
And he wasn't like, he certainly wasn't like the court jester, but he's never really, that's never really his persona. But like, he was, I would say there was a little bit of melancholy about the way he talks about this thing. And I think that's like also the privilege of having done the job at a high level for so long, is you can be real and not be, and who knows, like maybe he's leveraging for a contract negotiation. Like, I have no idea, but it did feel honest. It felt very honest. And to the thing you were saying about stamina and the exercise of staying ready to entertain, to make people laugh, et cetera, something really, I was asking someone who knows Donald Glover, who I really look up to because of how many things he is excellent at. That's like that's someone who I'm like trying to at least learn his process. And they were saying, man, the thing about him that is dynamic or that is special is like his physical stamina to be able to do 12 hours on set, go home, write a new sketch, go, you know, work on a song, go in the studio, perform the song, record it, go to a show in another country, come back. It's like these people that I am looking up to, I never realized how much they're taking care of their human body to be able to do what they do. I thought it, you know, you see it on TV and it's like, oh, these people must be going out and doing cocaine and hanging out and drinking like blah, blah, blah. And it's like, it doesn't seem to be the way.
No. I'm obsessed I interviewed Annie Murphy-Paul, who's a science writer, who has a book called The Extended Mind. And her thesis is that we get thinking wrong. Our metaphors for thinking are bad, like a computer or even the concept of growth mindset, in part because our bodies are talking to us first.
Oh, yes. That, right? I mean, that hugely resonates. Yeah.
And now I have just applied it in my life. So if I am feeling anxiety about something, I'm like, okay, no, there's probably something that very real that's happening here. So let's listen to it.
Yes.
And conversely, if I am in joy, through my body, it's like, okay, what is it that let's make sure I'm in that place. And I just think like, we're so like heady.
Yeah.
And we need to think, you know, about the other direction, I guess is what I'm saying.
100%. I think we start every sentence with that. I should say, I feel when I am, in it, let's just say for the podcast, for instance, when I find myself trying to do mental gymnastics to get to what's like the most poignant question I can ask right now, or what's like, you know, what's the most incisive thing I can say about the story this person just told? It usually leads me down what will end up feeling like a very contrived direction. And I think that the guest and I think my co-host can feel that. When I just kind of like almost blurt out the thing that like, when I just like, bleh, like just have to just get rid of whatever feelings in my body, it enters the room and I think it's like chunkier and people can actually engage with it. And a lot of times their chunky thing flies out too behind it. And I wonder if you feel this way too in doing your show. Like, to me, there's always that turning point, and you pray that the turning point is like the first minute where the conversation goes from heady to like, what do you really feel? Like, who really are you? Where are we really at with this thing? Do you have that experience as well?
Yeah. So my trick, for lack of a better term, is I always try to make my first question be something that they've never been probably asked before. Yeah. This was a little different because it was the podcast, and I had some other stuff here that I felt was going to be fine in terms of that conversation, and we'd talked before. But normally, I'll give you an example too. So I'm interviewing next week Marcus Buckingham, who's a New York Times bestselling author, a business guy, but his new book is called Love Plus Work, and it's a very, very big departure. I mean, basically, like, it's a cry for paying attention to the things we love as a part of our work. And honestly, like there's a 3/4 of the way through, there's this sort of, I won't give it away, but a dramatic turn. And I'm going to ask him, I think this is a book written out of trauma.
Ooh.
I do. I'm not trying to offend you. I don't like, you don't have to like go into that, but like, I think he will, because it's a book that's very real and very personal. And that shouldn't be a slam, because it's not. Like, people are going through traumas all the time and we don't talk about it.
And it's interesting too, because I think you can ask him that question in a way that not everybody can, because you don't have an attacking affect. No, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And some people do. Some people, it feels like you just sat in the chair and they're trying to cut you. And I think you can ask that question. You know, this is a non sequitur. I'm gonna get right back on track. It's just, so I played basketball growing up. When you described your story about soccer, I was like, my brain went so many places. I'm like, oh, did you quit because, you know, your dad put too much pressure and it was too much with the other boys, with your brothers? You wanted your own, all these things, because I have my own story. My dad played D1 basketball. I'm, you know, 5'8". Like, I'm a good ball player, but like, that was not going to be a professional inroad for me. But the thing I'm actually commenting here is, once you told me that you were a soccer player, I see you differently, because I see you, and now I'm like, oh, I see soccer player. I see like, do you know what I mean?
I don't give that vibe necessarily in terms of my age or any of that stuff. And it's interesting. My Bulls are in first place again, right? DeRozan's out of his mind. This is like the best. And I haven't had and I grew up right with those great Bulls teams.
Yes.
I will tell you too, it was probably my coach was the biggest problem, and in part because he was the coach at New Trier, which is a fairly prominent high school, and I was working out with the varsity team when I was in grade school.
Oh, wow.
So I was and he rode me. And it was like, I loved that game, and I was good at that game, but I stopped having any joy in that game.
Yeah.
And Buckingham, one of the things I like about this book that he just wrote is that he says, like, just because you're really good at something doesn't mean you should be doing it.
No doubt. That is, he's saying it better than us, but like, that is the essence of the show. Sure. I really think I could have climbed that Google ladder. Like, I think I have the combination of, like, you know, you need at least like B- level intelligence. You need like at least B sort of emotional intelligence to understand people. You need at least B+. If I'm being real, like you got to be able to chop some heads in that office building. Mm-hmm. And like, I think I could have got myself there, I think I could have been really good at it, but I think I would have hated it. I think I would not have enjoyed it. And if there's another entry point somewhere else along the way, hey, maybe so. But like, that way wasn't going to be it. So I commend that guy for putting it, you know, putting the philosophy in a better way. Can I ask the follow up, one quick follow up on that soccer question? So I'm doing this, I'm doing another project where I'm like going back and kind of like studying my high school origin story, which is very intertwined with basketball. And what I'm learning there is that like, it's the performance element of sport that I have underrated in how I have tried to bend my career arc. Like I miss the feeling of pressure of people like looking and listening to what's happening, and that sort of tension that's in the room that you don't get when you're sitting over a spreadsheet, right?
That's right.
Do you think that that performance element of soccer was in any way related to your pursuit of comedy?
Oh yeah, I like attention. My former boss said to me, people are your oxygen. So this idea of like, being seen, seeing others, connecting different people. So there's an element, I love jazz. Mm. So there's an element of being in flow with a soccer team that is similar to a great jazz band improvising. I find myself at Second City not knowing that they did improv necessarily. Like that was like, I like comedy. And then they're like, oh wow, this is again, I did my thesis on Jack Kerouac and the Beats, and that was improvised writing and also was community based. So I think I found something adjacent that still had, and I think this is where you're going with your question and your own story, which is like, oh, there were elements inside that were important as opposed to just basketball.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I honestly, I wasn't. I was just curious. But now that you say that, I mean, it is true. Just to sort of tie back into theme, you know, one thing that especially my mom, but others also say is, well, you wouldn't have been able to do X, Y, and Z had you not started there at Google. Like, had you not gotten that foundation of, and sure, like, I think there's truth to that. I learned a bunch of stuff that I am now applying in writing, in media, in Hollywood. But that is not to say, like, I never would have been able to apply those things had I never taken inventory of, is this really for me? This is great. I'm learning a lot of stuff here. But like, can I do another year of this? Like, can I do another 10 years of this, which is really the story that we're telling me? Like, I don't think so.
That's right. That's right. And it's hard to know. And I mean, and I've seen people who quit when they shouldn't have.
Yes.
You know, like that, where I'm just like, no, you had it. If you had just stayed a little bit, and that sucks too. But then, you know, who knows? Like, we're like, the only thing, it's not even a regret, but I sometimes wonder if I should have, when I was younger, gone to LA or New York and tried to do the thing that all my friends ended up succeeding in. Could I have become like a TV producer or a movie writer or, you know, whatever? But then I also sit here, I'm like, well, I'm like really happy where I am in Chicago and what I'm doing and built a family. And like, so, you know,
I was going to ask you that, like, I mean, cause that is the question, and I'm sure like everything, it's day to day, but I was going to ask, are you happy? You already answered that.
I'm happy.
And you know, for certain that some of those people, not all of them, are like,
not
they're
happy.
They're defined by their unhappiness. Like that is why they are great at what they do.
I think the only thing I'll say that is different about Second City people generally, it's not true of all of them, but of many of them, and I'll say Tina Fey and Stephen Colbert are too as well. And they wouldn't tell you their lives are perfect. They're not. They're messy. However, they really live by the improv credo in their life. Their job, they feel, is always to make other people look better. Very, very others focused. Believing that all of us are better than one of us. So, and they build ensembles around them of people that care about them and that they care about. And that is a quality I find in people who are happy. They have a lot of powerful, good, solid relationships. And it doesn't mean, I talked to my therapist about this last night. It's not like my wife and I socialize at all. Like, we don't go out to dinner parties or to, like, we'll see people occasionally and stuff, but we have tons of relationships that we've built throughout the years that we can pick up with people just like this. And I just think to go back to like the very early part of our conversation, like this human endeavor, let's not forget that this whole thing, this like human thing, is a human thing that we're all trying to do together. We don't do it alone.
Yeah, no. And you know, what's cool, And I don't even know sort of how it came about, but I am grateful that like I'm to be back here a year, I think a year later from our first conversation. But it is cool because I'm so early on the journey. Like it's cool to start to see like, oh, like, you know, this one is like actually taking an interest. Like maybe they think that the story is interesting as it's developing. Maybe they're taking an interest in me personally. That is meaningful. Like I really appreciate that. And what I'll also say is like, depending on what the thing is that we are discussing, depending on what the turkey is on the table, like I see a completely different dimension of you today than I did a year ago. You know, I would have described you as one person then. Now I'm like, wow, there's this whole other room of stuff that I didn't know was there. And I know there's 1,000 more of those. And that to me is like, you know, a coach said that people are your oxygen. Yeah. And I think for me, I would be specific to say like the stories that people have are my oxygen. Cause I'm really not an extrovert, but if someone gets to talking about something that like is really emotionally charging them in any direction, I can sit there and listen to that for a really, really long time. Like I can really get into that.
Well, and that's why your path now makes more sense than the other path. You need to be in the storytelling business, and it can be your story. It can be other stories. That's fine. And this is how we learn. This is like you don't learn from like, you learn some stuff from data, but data is meaningless if you don't have the story behind it.
100%. Yeah.
So, I know we normally end the podcast with the yes and story, and you did that last time. I got another idea, and you don't have to, but do you have a no story? A good no story?
Do I have a good no story? Do I have a good no story? Well, I have a good story of someone else telling me no. Does that count?
Okay. Yeah, for sure.
Because my good no stories are happening now, and I'm really loving it, man. I'm not to go. This can be our next conversation.
Hey, you said
maybe,
no to Spotify like before that was like in fashion.
I did. Yes, I did. I mean, I did because they. And I don't want to say too much because I hope they make me a much better offer the next time around. But like they made me an offer that made me think. They think Brené Brown just like dragged in some dude off the street and it offended me, but that's okay. I'll be back. Here's the no. So, and this was an important no that the universe gave me. So I was a couple years out of Google. This was when I was like truly completely unemployed and not making any money and running out of money. And I had been invited to come out to LA to work with someone, to write for someone, a producer for like a couple weeks or something like that. And, but I'm running out of money and I know like, and I've done enough of these LA trips. And at this point that I just know that there, who knows if there's anything on the other end of this.
Totally.
So I'm sitting on the plane and I have just interviewed for a recruiting job at a tech company. And this little tiny startup, because I got scared and I was like, I'm just going to go back. And I got the email sitting on the tarmac on the runway to go out there that I did not get the job. And the reason, and I did not even realize this, was basically he wrote that the reason is because I came into my interview, which was supposed to be an interview about being a tech recruiter. And I talked about writing for 90% of the time. Yeah. And that to me was like, that was the most profound no that God was giving me, that like, it's like, dude, you know what you want to do. You're sitting on a tarmac about to take off to go keep trying to do it. Like, don't try to find an escape hatch. It's not time yet. And so that's the opposite of quitting, right? That's like, that's like, stick with it. You're almost there. And you know, and I was almost there. And
was that the intent? Did you feel that was the intent of that no? Or is that what you just, it was your epiphany?
I think that was the intent of the no from
that's the
creator. I think from the recruiter, I mean, from the manager, I think the no was like, you're the wrong guy for the job. You don't care about this. And he was right. And I had self-sabotaged. I told him that basically in so many words. But, you know, in my arrogance at that moment, I thought, oh, if I ever need to go back to tech, I can. Not true.
Right. I love it. The podcast is called Quitters. I think you can get it on any place where you get pods. I just found it. I looked it up on whatever I'm using right now. I think it's Apple.
Yeah, Spotify, Apple, wherever you get pods. You can go to our website, which is quitterspod.com. You can follow me at Chad Sand on Instagram. I'm giving, you know, all the announcements about the show. We come out every Monday. We've had myself, Julie, Ty Burrell, Jimmy Kimmel, and we've got new guests who you know coming out every Monday.
Chad Sanders, thank you for coming back on the show.
Thank you so much for having me again.
The Getting to Yes And podcast is produced by The Second City and WGN Radio. We are supported at The Second City by Mike Farinaccio and Colleen Fahey. Our show is produced by Andrew Harris at WGN. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of the podcast is by Jukebox The Ghost. If you're interested in knowing more about The Second City, you can log on to secondcity.com or email us at works@secondcity.com.
Survive.